I thought I'd talk tonight a bit about loss, how our practice helps us to understand the nature of loss and helps us to deal with it. I think it comes up for me because I've been aware of so much loss among people that I know recently. And it can be very, very painful. It can be a very difficult thing to deal with. And I think our understanding as practitioners can be of great help in experiencing loss. Not that it takes away the pain or the disappointment or the feelings, but that somehow we have a context. We have a way of holding loss. We understand that it's inevitable, that it happens to all of us. Actually, we all experience losses, both small and large, every day, all the time. So it's not a mistake. It's not a quirk of nature. It is, in fact, the nature of life. It reminds us of the central teaching of impermanence, that nothing lasts. Everything is subject to change, in case you hadn't noticed. Everything that comes into being, everything that is born, will die. That's its nature. From a thought, you know, something so elusive as a thought, to a treasured item, a thing, to life. All of it will end. Nothing lasts forever. Although I think sometimes some things and some people stay for so long that we forget. You know, we forget they also are impermanent and will die or will fade away, will disappear. And then when we forget, it can be a big shock when the loss happens. This reading on loss, a poem from Izumi Shikibu. Through the years, I've become used to sorrow. There was not one spring I didn't leave behind the flowers. And then the commentary. Izumi is sharing a simple truth. It isn't dramatic. It isn't embroidered with layers or images. It is this. Flowers are born and flowers die. In that dying, in that loss, there is sadness. Sadness acknowledged in this way is not held. It is seen, felt, and released. Izumi knows that life is cyclical. There are losses. There is sadness, and there is more than sadness. There is joy and beauty as well. Ruth Denison, a revered teacher, explains that when the mind acknowledges the truth of impermanence, it relaxes. It relaxes into itself. There is an acceptance of life and a lightness that comes from seeing through the confusion. The mind is balanced. So there are many kinds of losses that we all experience. And we don't know when, how, or how long we're going to experience a particular loss. We might have a loss of a treasured thing. I was thinking driving up here tonight that over the last few years I have lost 3 very treasured bracelets, just gone. And the mind reacted to those losses similarly to the loss of life, to the loss of my father or my brother many, many years ago. At first, there's this shock, you know, this surprise, and a sense of denial, a sense of, no, it must be right here. Oh, it's just over here. And a frantic search, you know, thinking any moment I'll come up with it. And then there's the if only part. well, if only I hadn't worn it today, or if only I hadn't, whatever, taken it off, or whatever I had done. And I've noticed it takes a bit for the mind to actually accept that it's lost, that it's gone. And there's a lot of confusion and a lot of sort of back and forth before I actually accept it's gone. Sometimes it's a matter of minutes, sometimes it's a matter of hours, sometimes it's a matter of days. And I think many people experience that with death. You know, there's that shock and a sense of denial. No, it didn't really happen. It's too much for the mind to accept all at one time. And so it has to go through a process of denying and then recognizing and then maybe hoping, wishing, and then accepting. And there can be many, many feelings associated with any loss. Of course, sadness usually, grief. But there can be also relief. There can be anger, there can be fear, there can be disappointment, frustration. And there might also be joy, or it might be all mingled in. Usually the feelings are not so distinct, they're not so separate. They tend to sort of come and go and mesh with other feelings. And it's important that in our understanding, we don't try to deny any of these feelings, that we allow them all, and we allow them fully. They will process. They will change. They will go, just like everything else. But if we don't accept them, if we try to push them away, pretend they aren't there, put on a happy face or whatever, then it takes longer. Or we might get stuck in our sadness or stuck in our grief. But I want to emphasize this because I think sometimes I know I can have a tendency with understanding at a deep level that change is inevitable, that everything is impermanent and everything will go. Every one of us will die. None of us is immune. That means none of our friends, our family, our loved ones are immune. Everyone will die. And to get that on a very deep level can bring a sense of equanimity, an acceptance where the mind doesn't get so rattled. But with that, then, we have to be careful that we don't either become insensitive or try to block out the natural feelings that are there. Just because we understand impermanence, we understand and accept death or loss of any kind, doesn't mean we don't have feelings about it. We can still have great, deep sadness or the others, anger, fear, confusion, whatever. So we don't want in any way to try to downplay those feelings or ignore them. They are to be accepted, fully accepted. And then they too will have their time and will dissipate or will disappear. Another reading from Izumi. Listen, listen, longing and loss. In the struck bell's recurrent calling, no moment in which to forget. And the commentary. Our lives are filled with losses. It is our attitude toward inevitable loss that determines our capacity for joy. One of my relationships ended very abruptly. The loss provided me with a precious opportunity to practice mindfulness. By bringing mindfulness to every feeling and thought that arose in my mind, I was able to work with a difficult situation. The sudden loss was like a slap in the face, and I woke up. In the struck bell's recurrent calling, no moment in which to forget. No moment in which to forget. Waking up, remembering, is joy. So she suggests that the way we hold the loss, the attitude that we bring to the loss, determines the suffering or not. If we think, this shouldn't be, this shouldn't happen, this is terrible, something's wrong, I did something wrong, or there's something wrong with life, or I'm being punished, or, you know, what happened to God, how come he allowed this to happen, or whatever, whatever interpretation we might put on it, then in my experience, that's what leads to people suffering. And I'm talking about suffering beyond the sadness. We can be sad, but not suffer. Pure sadness isn't necessarily suffering. It's just sadness. But the suffering comes when we add to it, when we make something of it that is not necessarily true. Most of the time, we don't know. You know, why did my brother die at 27? I have no idea. I know what I experienced because of that death. I know the loss. I have no idea why. Or my dad. Why did my dad die when my daughter was 2 years old and she wouldn't have a grandfather? I don't know. I can tell you what has happened since and how I've grown, but I don't know that that's why he died. I don't have any idea. I have a good friend right now who was going to adopt a little baby girl. And this was an open adoption. She had this relationship with the birth mother. I had even given her all my daughter's clothes from when she was little. And, you know, there was all this excitement and preparation for this baby. So the baby was born 2 weeks ago today. I can't remember if that was the due date or not. But anyway, my friend was on a plane back to Ohio where the baby was and got off the plane, went to a phone and called. And yes, the baby had been born, but she was born with severe birth defects and lived only a very few hours. Totally unexpected. You know, there had been nothing to suggest there was going to be a problem. So last week when I saw my friend, she said, you know, what does this mean? We can't have a child. The child we were going to adopt dies. Does this mean we shouldn't have children? And I just shrugged and said, no, we don't know. This is life. It happens. We don't know. How helpful that was, I don't know. I hope it was helpful. She nodded as if, yes. Not to undercut the sadness, but also not to encourage or not to support somebody making some story out of it. Because how do we know? You know, they may reapply, get a baby very quickly, and be very happy. You know, it does not necessarily mean they shouldn't adopt or they shouldn't have another child. We don't know. I have another friend who has been married 34 years. And in the last 2 months, her husband has decided he doesn't want to be married anymore. Shock. Total shock. Again, she says, no indication. Nothing leading up to it. Just all of a sudden, you know. Midlife crisis, whatever, who knows. The suddenness, you know, in both of these cases is like Izumi talks about the bell. It's that wake-up call. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Everything is impermanent. And we don't know. We don't know when. We don't know how the loss is going to happen. And at first, that might seem cold or callous. But as we contemplate it And as we deeply get it, as we deeply understand, then I think it's supportive. It's a reminder that we don't know and that loss can happen at any time. Any one of us could be killed tonight driving home. And again, that's not morbid. That's just the reality. You know, Ajahn Sundara got sick. She was supposed to be here all this week. She had a heart attack last week and isn't here. Fortunately, in that case, she's going to be fine. We have a loss, you know. We don't get to have her. We don't get to have her teachings. And that is a loss for all of us. She's a wonderful, inspiring teacher. We just don't know. And sometimes I think living with that don't know can be very difficult, very challenging. But the more we get it, the more we understand, the more we realize that we don't know, and that everything, literally everything, will one day disappear. Then, as Ruth Denison says, the mind sort of relaxes. You know, then we can let go of some of the striving or the holding on to, the clutching, because we understand there's nothing really to clutch, to hold on to. What's going to happen is going to happen. And holding on, clutching it, doesn't help. It makes us tight and tense, might make us irritable, might make us really unpleasant to those around us, and it's not going to help a thing. But when we deeply understand, then we can relax. We don't have to clutch. We don't have to hold on so tightly to anything. I can almost assure you that anything that you're too strongly attached to will disappear somehow. I've seen it in my life. I've seen it in other people's life. And it's not about punishment. You know, it's not that you're bad because you're holding on so tightly. But it's like the bell again. It's a wake-up call. It's reminding us. And it's helping to set us free. Because when we're clutching too tightly, we're not free. It's very unpleasant, as I'm sure you've noticed, to clutch, to be too attached, to hang on, is not comfortable. It's not free. And if we want to be free, and I believe life, however we see that, wants us to be free. So however it works, you can almost be sure that anything you clutch too tightly, you hang on too tightly, is going to disappear. It's going to happen. So accepting then means letting go. Letting go of that clutching. Letting go of our idea or ideas that we know how it should be. Because we don't. What we know is how we would like it to be. But that's not necessarily how it is. And life tells us day after day after day, time after time, how it really is. And many of us, most of us probably, try to deny that. We try to push that away and pretend. That's not how it is because that's not how I want it to be. It should be this way because that's how I want it. Byron Katie, some of you may have heard of her, a teacher not in the Buddhist tradition, has written a book called Loving What Is. And it's this very idea that instead of wanting things to be the way we want them, learning to love the way things are. Because that's the way we find freedom. When we love, when we accept things just as they are, that's how we are free. And that's how our lives can be joyful, can be happy and fulfilling, even when we don't get what we want, or we lose what we have, and we don't like that. So as I'm speaking tonight, I'm thinking both in terms of ourselves, loss for ourselves, our own loss, and for people around us. So it occurs to me, how do we support, how do we help other people that are going through loss? Because it's all around us, right? It's happening every day. And how can we best support each other, support others that are going through loss? And the first thing that comes to my mind is the acceptance, you know, accepting the event and accepting the emotions around the event, our own emotions and those of somebody else, because there are no right or wrong emotions. Depending on the loss, depending on what it is, who it is, there may be all kinds of feelings. And they're not right or wrong. They come and go. They're mixed. And our job is simply to accept them. If somebody is in total denial, then that's what they need to do for a period of time, then we accept that. If somebody is raging, angry, then we accept that. We don't make them wrong for feeling these feelings. In fact, anger is quite common in the event of death. Actually, it's quite common in the event of almost any loss. There can be a lot of anger. And that's not wrong. It might not be fun, but it's not wrong. It's just the way it is. So accepting our own and others' feelings begins the healing process. And then you've probably all read The Stages. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross so well elucidated, especially in regard to death, where there is this denial. There may be anger. There may be bargaining, bargaining with life, bargaining with God. You know, if only, bring this person back and I'll do whatever. Before we finally come to the acceptance. And the acceptance comes and goes. We may accept one moment, and then the next moment we're raging, or we're denying, or we're totally not accepting. Another friend of mine lost her husband last year, just a year ago. Wasn't unexpected, but nevertheless, a great loss. He was the one person in her life who had totally accepted her and loved her unconditionally. So you can imagine that was a huge loss for her. And she seemed to be accepting it really well. But she went through this, you know, accepting and not accepting, accepting and denying, accepting and anger. And it's been a process, and it goes on. You know, a year is a relatively short time for a death. So being there for her, just, you know, checking in with her once in a while, doing something with her, you know, going over for lunch or taking her for a walk or whatever, just something. Doesn't have to be big things, and with this person it hasn't been. Just that check-in call or just that occasional walk, knowing that I'm there and that I understand her grief, that she's free to cry, to be angry, to be numb if she wants. That's perfectly fine. Then I think we can very gently, when appropriate, and that's a big when, remind people of the impermanence. Remind people of the change. That loss is inevitable through death or divorce or whatever. Sometimes people don't really want to hear that. Sometimes it's very hard to hear. But even if it is, it can be supportive. Even if somebody at the moment balks and doesn't want to hear it, I think down the road it can be useful. It can be a reminder. And that reminds me of the story that probably many of you have heard of Kisa Gotami, who lived at the time of the Buddha and lost her only son to illness and death. And she was so bereft, she was so filled with grief, that she was in total denial. And she walked through the village with her son in her arms, asking everyone for medicine for her son. Medicine for her son. People, of course, thought she had lost her mind. And she came upon this one wise man who said, "I know who has medicine for your son." And he sent her to the Buddha. And she went to the Buddha. And what he said to her was, "Gotami, I want you to go and find a home in this village where no one has died, and bring me a mustard seed from that home." And somehow she trusted the Buddha. She felt that he was indeed a sage. And so she went from home to home to home in that village and asked, "Has anyone died here?" "Oh, yes. Oh, yes." Time after time, she was told, "Oh, yes. Grandfather died. Uncle died. So-and-so died. So-and-so died. So-and-so died." She couldn't find a single house in the village where there had been no death. And she got it. She went back to the Buddha. And she understood. And she took her son to the outskirts of town and buried him. "Dear little son, I thought that you alone had been overtaken by this thing which men call death. But you are not the only one death has overtaken. This is a law common to all mankind." So saying, she cast her son away in the burning ground. Then she uttered the following stanza: "No village law, no law of market towns, no law of a single house is this. Of all the world and all the worlds of gods, this only is the law, that all things are impermanent." So it seems like, I didn't mean to, but it just seems to happen that talking about loss, I talk mostly about death. Maybe because that's the biggest loss that any of us face. But there are many other kinds of losses. There is the loss of something valuable, which probably all of us have experienced. There's the loss of identity. Some of us long for that and then fight it as it happens, or find it very uncomfortable as it happens. There can be the loss of a job, the loss of a skill, the loss of an opportunity, the loss, say, of the use of some part of our body, the loss of a set of beliefs, ideas. There are many, many losses. And they can, depending on how we see them, they can all be very painful. They can all be very challenging. And each one will be different for each one of us. But if we understand this deep belief that everything, I shouldn't say belief, it's not a belief, this deep recognition, understanding that all things are impermanent, all things that have the nature to be born have the nature to pass away. That's just how it is. Then when we accept that and understand that, we don't have to add the suffering on top of it. We experience the loss, we experience the sadness, whatever else there is, but not the suffering not the if-onlys, or it shouldn't be, or he was too young, or she was too good, or whatever other interpretations we might want to put on it. It's just how it is. And if we can accept that, then we bring that equanimity to somebody else who is suffering a loss. So even if we don't say anything, we may choose to say nothing about the nature of impermanence or about how we have to accept. But just our equanimity, our being, our groundedness will be supportive to that person. We won't encourage, you know, the interpretation, the story, the suffering on top of it. We might allow them to do whatever they need to do, but we won't add to it. We won't add fuel to it. And in fact, we will be grounded and we will be a strength for that person. Then I can't underscore enough, I think, the gentleness and the kindness for ourselves and for somebody else that might be experiencing loss. You know, it's a pretty raw time, isn't it? All three of the friends that I've mentioned are pretty raw right now. And it seems to me that a gentleness and a kindness is what they need most. They need support. They need it in a kind and gentle way. And when we're experiencing that loss, that's what we need also from ourselves. You know, it's not our fault. It's important to remember that. It's not our fault. Even if we have some responsibility, which we might have some responsibility in the loss, that doesn't make it our fault. And that can be a great relief, because if we think it's our fault, we did it, we somehow caused it, that too is going to add to the suffering. But if we see that, you know, there are causes and conditions, there are probably multiple reasons why anything happens, then we see that it's not our fault. We may have a piece in it. We may be part of the cause or condition, but that doesn't make it our fault. And we don't need to add that additional suffering by thinking, if only, or if I had, or if I hadn't. Who knows? If I had or if I hadn't, it may still have happened. We just don't know. So we have a few minutes left. I'd like to invite your responses, questions, comments, sharing of your experience, maybe.
I like to talk very much, but on the subject of fault, one of the things that I think I've observed is that when a person truly is at fault for something, probably accepting that they are at fault is the best way to deal with it. And that the most difficult things in a person's life, I think, are those cases where they know that they have committed a wrong act, they've hurt another person. And perhaps the easiest way to deal with that is to accept that rather than say it's not.
Yes, there's a lot of wisdom in that, a lot of truth. I prefer the word responsibility to fault, because I agree that it is very important to take personal responsibility for whatever might have happened. I see that as different from blaming ourselves or getting lost in the "it's my fault" guilt. Maybe you have a good example, but I'm thinking in almost every circumstance, it's not totally my fault. There are extenuating circumstances. There are, as the Buddha said, numerous causes and conditions. And I don't mean to imply in any way that we should push aside personal responsibility. and not be responsible for whatever our actions have created. But I see that as different from blaming or it's all my fault. I think it very rarely is. Does that fit?
Yes, yeah.
My feeling about that, there's that part of it is that we're all given to be human beings. And human beings have a less than 100% perfect record ahead of us, a life ahead of us, we make mistakes. And that's a given for you. So it's really not wrong in the sense that you're saying it's not a fault, it's an expression of being a human being. Yeah, I may have done something really wrong and actually directly caused somebody to die. But I should not have done that. But so, not much to do except accept it.
Accepting our humanness, accepting our limitations,
yeah.
Our frailties, and
someone who has a lot of anger, and I sometimes try to explain this concept of separating the emotion from the story of the emotion. And somehow it doesn't click with this person. And especially in anger, it is kind of, in some sense, kind of all wrapped up. There's a story of so-and-so wrong to me, and there's feelings associated with that story, and then there may be other stories that the top of that, I'll always be wrong or whatever. But that bridge story does seem very integral to the anger. So is it possible to separate that original story, or is that something that you just can't really separate from the emotion itself?
Can we separate the story from the emotion?
Right. Because the emotion is just, whatever, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems it's to me that I can, this person doesn't understand that. And so I guess I'm looking for how to explain that process.
The process of how the story feels the anger and the anger feels the story, right? And then we're off and rolling. Yes. Say, given an event, I'm going to say event as opposed to story, because we can separate the event from the story. So often the story is an overlay. You know, it's an interpretation of the event or events. And it's often that overlay, that interpretation, that fuels the anger or the feelings. Often the event itself is neutral. It's just an event. Well,
at least let's use an example.
Yeah.
So-and-so wronged
someone?
Wrong me.
Yeah, yeah. Even wronged is a story.
Yeah.
An example that comes to my mind is a couple of weeks ago, I was sitting out. I live in a townhouse complex, and I was sitting out in the common area in the grass, and the sprinklers went on. And, you know, it was like, I don't know, 10 o'clock in the morning or something like that. And immediately there was the anger, you know. What are these? So I went in and called the gardener. What are the sprinklers doing on at 10 o'clock in the morning? I was sitting out there, blah, 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 you know. My story was they shouldn't have been on. Perhaps he saw me sitting out there and purposely turned them on. And then, to make matters worse, well, so I left him a message. He came by and said, you know, hey, we just fertilized the lawn. That's why the sprinklers are on. Okay. So I moved my chair a little bit. He saw where I was. He said, if we'd known you were there, we wouldn't have turned them on. So he drives away, and within 3 minutes, the sprinklers go on right where I am. This time, I know he did it on purpose, right? I went storming through that complex, you know. How dare you, little Lily? Well, fortunately, I couldn't find him. So I came back home. By this time, you know, I'm sort of chuckling to myself. And I got to the point, fortunately, where I could laugh. I thought, if I didn't believe that he had done this to me on purpose, it would have been kind of funny. It was kind of, you know, so you get a little wet, big deal. You dry off very quickly, you know. That was a clear example where the story totally created the anger. You know, it was not about the event. The event was kind of funny. I didn't even get that wet. Just a little bit, and so what? So the event clearly was not the reason. But it was my story. It was my, you know, believing that this man doesn't like me, and, you know, he was out to get me. And anyway, how ridiculous to turn on sprinklers at 10 o'clock in the morning when people were out on the grass. And I could let go of it when I saw how silly it was. And when I saw that the event itself could be funny, I let go of it. Does that speak to
that? Yeah. No, it speaks to me.
That may not. Yeah. But in that case, I can separate. I can see clearly the event, the story, and the emotion. And I can see the interconnection. And as so often happens with me, when I see my part, I can let go. It goes away. Yes.
What strikes me about, I mean, maybe this is always the case, but that example is that even if you really did turn them on purpose, it was still your story.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really funny, too. The next day, I spoke with him, and he said something like, well, don't go thinking we did it on purpose. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, that's very interesting. What made you think I was thinking that? So there may have been a little truth.
But I think it's a funny story even if he did do.
Yeah. It is. Go ahead.
Some people in your position would have said, well, they did do it on purpose. Now what am I going to do to get back at him?
It probably crossed my mind. I don't remember. I'm very glad that I didn't find him, though. I was very aware of that. I am so glad that I didn't find him. Totally inappropriate anger, you know.
You would have embarrassed yourself.
And it's a challenging relationship, and it would not have helped one bit. And I would have felt embarrassed to get so upset over, you know, the sprinkler, for heaven's sake. I don't know that I would be that that I would go that far. I do think, though, yes, it is better to think in terms of responsibility. Fault has so much blame and such negative connotation. And as Dick suggested, seems to forget the humanness that we all have. And to forget, as the Buddha said, there are so many causes and conditions for everything that happens, that it's not just, you know, a one-to-one relationship. That's how karma gets so misunderstood in this society, People tend to throw around the word karma very loosely and often meaning a one-to-one causation, and it's not. It's not. There are many factors that go into any event, and what we do is one of them. It might be a large percentage, but it's never all. Does that help?
I was just thinking, sometimes people seem to me to be thinking of karma as a punishment, you know, a getting even with you for some behavior or something that happened, and, which doesn't seem
right. Karma is totally neutral. Yeah, there's no sense of punishment. It's totally neutral. Yeah.
I was just thinking about both of these discussions, this one and about the fault and responsibility, that there's something about the way we propagate the past into the future. You know, so something happened in the past, like maybe somebody really did harm you in some way, and you really are, you know, you really were angry when that happened, or maybe you really did something. But in any case, both of those things are events that are in the past. And when the memory of it comes up in the present, it's really just a memory then. And, you know, at that point, you have a choice of what you do in the present to influence the future. And if you blame yourself, you know, if you take the opportunity of remembering something that you did wrong to be angry at yourself, then you're just practicing anger. And or if you take the opportunity of remembering that event to get angry again, you're just, you know, exercising your own body's angry response then. And, you know, neither one of those things is really skillful for the future, and that's all you can do in the present is to do something that helps, you know, helps the future. You can't really go back and beat up the past over and over again.
Right. Right, thank you. Could you all hear that? Yeah.
The actual incidents forgotten are no longer brought to mind. I can actually remember things when I was 2 years old. But the things that caused the anger and the rage, I still am a very loud person. But I've learned how to overcome this through a lot of process that I've learned for myself. But the things that actually happened to me that caused the anger and the rage, I do not remember. I know that, or I feel that it is a protection. The anger and the rage is a protection. It's a self-protection that proves I am real. Mm-hmm. I am alive. Mm-hmm. And it gets to be a habit. Mm-hmm. And this is what I think you're talking about, is it's a habit to protect yourself. You don't know what you're doing. You just do it. Something that's very difficult to overcome. And I, through the process that I've gone through recently, I've got a big door that was open where I can work with.
Great.
To the point that even left a big empty box that I can go into and find solitude and recentering. And a year ago, before I came here, I didn't even know what a center was. A pencil point.
Wonderful.
I've got a lot out of being here, and you are the process that I've gone through. This anger and rage, I see it. I see it in myself. I can accept it. I can even accept the shame that I have for what I did. I can see it in my son. I can see how it's calming down, too, the way I am now. Which is nice. So
yes.
The calmer I get, the better he gets.
It has an effect on him.
It's just hard to overcome the rage and anger.
Because it, as you say, it became so ingrained, it was such a habit.
Yeah, I was put through a process that left it all behind.
Wonderful.
If I knew how to do that, I could probably get rich.
I also would challenge, and maybe you've already done this, the idea that it is protective. We think it is. We think the anger is protective. But I've come to see that it's really not. You know, that's probably what it's about. That's probably why we do it. But it's a false protection because it closes us down.
And it keeps the hurt away.
And
also.
That's right. It keeps
and
everyone away. And that's right.
The hurt is really not there.
That's right.
It keeps people away if you think of hurting.
And it can end up being more hurtful than if we had allowed whatever the original event was. Yeah. Good.
Once the suicide, I experienced I've had visitors in my family with suicide. And, we grow up, some of us with religious beliefs, life is truly a gift. And I just found that the exploration of that, just had such depth in it. And it really took, in regards to my father's suicide, it really took some time for me to get in touch with all those things, to sort out my own feelings, to sort out what he did. It has many implications that, just a regular kind of death doesn't, but it was real liberating for me to experience these things. I worked at the Veterans Administration for a number of years, too, on their lock units, and numerous fellows committed suicide there, so I've been around a lot of suicide. That's one that can really catch you by surprise.
Yes. Yes. And it's one where it's so easy to fall into, if only, or it's my fault, or...
If I could have done something,
I should have done something.
Yeah. But the truth is that a lot of people, they are just unreachable. You cannot reach them. And even with the greatest intent that you have.
Right. And that's where it can be useful to understand that there are causes and conditions way beyond just what we do. We're one piece of it, but it's much, much bigger than that, much, much more. Okay, shall we sit for the last 5 minutes? And I'll do some metta. So bringing your attention to the area of your heart, noticing and allowing whatever is there. The heart may be open and soft, or it may be closed, tight. Just notice whatever. And remembering that loving kindness is about opening the heart. We begin with ourselves. I'll say a few phrases and you can repeat them to yourselves in your mind. May I be happy. May I live with ease in this world. May I know peace. May I realize true freedom. And bringing to mind someone that you know who has experienced loss, maybe recently or in the past. And we wish for that person, as we wished for ourselves, may you be happy. May you live with ease. May you know peace. May you find true freedom. And we extend our loving kindness throughout the world to all beings everywhere. May all beings be happy. May all beings live with ease. May all beings know peace. May all beings find true freedom. May it be so.
Please have a safe drive home.